Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Thad Woodard. Just as we thought coronary artery disease and heart disease was going to be killing all of us, the incidence of these problems, heart disease, particularly coronary artery disease or disease of the arteries of the heart, have been declining. And I want to better understand why that is, with the idea that all of us may benefit from understanding why the incidence of new coronary artery disease and the death rates from heart disease, particularly coronary artery disease, are declining. And so to do that, I have asked Gene Quinn, who is the Medical Director of Quality and Population Health and a active cardiologist at the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute here in Anchorage, to come and help us understand those things. Because of his unique ability or unique training as well, from Harvard in the patient quality and safety aspects, I would like to also spend a little bit of time talking about that. So today's program is going to be on heart disease, primarily coronary artery disease, which we'll define why it happens, what we can do to maybe prevent it, why rates are declining. Maybe a little bit about treatment. It's not going to be my big emphasis. And then some patient quality safety issues. And as you know, you can get a hold of us and ask questions or send in comments by email. The way you do that, if you're in Anchorage, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and an email address at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Quinn, it's been a pleasure talking with you before the show goes on, and welcome to Line One.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Those people who have listened to me in the past know I'd like to start with definitions. So I want to know, what is cardiovascular disease? What is coronary artery disease? What is heart failure? Those are big, big things that people may hear.
Fair enough. So cardiovascular disease really encompasses a lot of things. That's anything, any disorder of the cardiovascular system, which includes the heart, but it also includes the vessels that feed the heart, the vessels that come off of the heart, including the aorta, etc. The two other things that you said, heart failure and coronary artery disease, are subsets of that big umbrella of cardiovascular disease. And coronary artery disease is a disease of the coronary arteries. The coronary arteries are the blood supply to the heart. The heart is a muscle like any other muscle, and it needs a certain blood supply. It needs to get blood to be able to function. And the arteries that come off of the aorta and feed the heart muscle itself are called the coronary arteries. Heart failure is a related but a different term. And heart failure is another umbrella that just means that the heart isn't pumping enough to keep up with what the body needs. The heart is a muscle, but the heart is also a pump. And if it can't keep up and can't pump enough blood, then it's called heart failure. And that blood and fluid that backs up can cause lots of different symptoms.
So disease of the coronary arteries then prevents the heart itself, which is mainly muscle, and don't hesitate to correct me
if I'm wrong,
from getting enough oxygen, and that, I would guess, could be a big reason for failure, but not the only reason for heart failure.
Yeah, that's good. So you're exactly right. So the heart is a muscle that pumps, and it needs a certain blood supply. It's just like an engine that has a fuel line. And if that fuel line gets plugged up, the engine doesn't get enough fuel to it. It doesn't get enough gas, and that's the exact same thing. It causes coronary artery disease, which is one of the things that causes heart attacks. And if you have heart attacks, a heart attack is basically when the heart doesn't get enough blood and then causes damage to the heart. If you get enough damage to the heart, then that part of the muscle won't work anymore, and then it doesn't pump as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't pump as well, if you get enough damage, then if it can't keep up with the amount of pumping that it needs, then you can get heart failure. So there are many causes of heart failure. Coronary artery disease or blockages of the vessels and heart attacks is one of them and one of the leading causes. But there are other causes as well.
Tell us a couple of more because people may think that's the only thing. What are other big, maybe major categories of things that may affect, may lead to heart failure?
Yeah, so we categorize them in two. Well, there's always buckets. You can always put things into buckets. One of the buckets is if the heart, when we look at it, is pumping well or not pumping very well, and that's one category of heart failure. The other, like I was talking about with coronary artery disease, is what we call ischemic or non-ischemic. And ischemia is a fancy word for not getting enough blood. Mm-hmm. So if the heart has failed because of too many heart attacks, because of blockages of the coronary arteries, then that's ischemic. And then there are other non-ischemic ways to that you can get heart failure. That can be alcohol use, that can be drug use, that can be
So those
hereditary.
Are toxic to the muscle without affecting the blood supply.
That's exactly correct.
Right? Mm-hmm. Or viral infections could damage the heart or any infection.
Mm-hmm. Viral is one of the biggest categories, yep. And sometimes we never find out why people have heart failure, but but those are reasons for the heart not to pump well. Mm-hmm. And when the heart doesn't pump well, then the fluid can back up and the pressures in the heart back up, and that's what causes the symptoms of heart failure.
So one other thing that might be worth mentioning, and I don't want to get into the whole anatomy of the heart because it's difficult, but there is a conduction system, and that conduction system can also be damaged through multiple mechanisms, and that's not necessarily good.
Yeah,
tell me about the conduction system. What's the purpose there?
Definitely not good for the conduction system to be damaged. So the heart, the heart has a plumbing system, if we want to use that analogy, which is the coronary arteries to feed the blood. But it also has an electrical system, which is why the heart is able to pump. The heart has a natural pacemaker and has a natural electrical system that allows the heart beat at a certain rate and is the rhythm of the heart. And any number of parts of that can be damaged, and sometimes that leads to needing medications or sometimes procedures to fix the electrical system, or sometimes ends up in a pacemaker.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's go back to those coronary arteries that are supplying the heart muscle. Mm-hmm. And give me some idea of the size and what's going on inside those vessels and what leads to coronary artery disease. Paint me a picture of what we call pathophysiology here.
Absolutely. So so it depends upon the person, it depends upon the vessel, but they're usually on the order of a few millimeters. There are quite a few of them, but there are three main ones, and they branch off. It's almost like, I like to think of it as a lawn that you're watering. You have a sprinkler system, and you want to water all of your lawn, and there are pipes that feed that whole lawn. And when one gets blocked up, then there's part of your lawn or part of your heart that's not getting enough water or blood, depending upon which part of my analogy you're using. So what causes that? So we usually think of these blockages as caused by cholesterol, and what it really is that there is cholesterol and calcium in them, but it's not just cholesterol that causes them. It's a very complex thing that causes them, but we usually talk about risk factors. Who is more likely to have coronary artery disease and blockages of the arteries? That's males, that's increasing age, people that smoke, people that have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, a family history of cardiac disease, especially at an early age, and then have high blood pressure and diabetes. Those are some of the main ones, but there are quite a few.
And each one of those risk factors may cause damage to the coronary arteries in different ways. Is that true? And then obviously they could combine to do multiple kinds of damage.
Yeah, so all of those things increase the risk for having coronary artery disease, for having blockages of the arteries.
Right.
The blockages themselves, they form early. We know from autopsy studies of, unfortunately, of motor vehicle accidents mm-hmm. and trauma that even people in their 20s have at least the beginnings of these blockages of the arteries, the cholesterol buildup in the arteries that feed the heart muscle. Mm-hmm. And they progress over a number of years. All of those lifestyle things can contribute to them, and there are lots of different theories on how they exactly start. We think that it has something to do with inflammation, and honestly, I'm sure that there are biologists that know much more about the exact molecular mechanisms that that start it. But all of those things contribute to the risk of having those blockages of the arteries. Mm-hmm.
It's natural to think, as we were having more and more trouble, I guess, in the 70s with heart disease, that it's something we were doing to ourselves. But then I remember several interesting MRI or CT studies that came out on mummies 2,000 years old that showed they had cardiovascular disease. So this has always been a problem in humans. But if we look at a long-term time scale, we suddenly started having more and more problems in Western society, which is now seeming to be changing for the better. Is that fair to say, or am I overinterpreting a lot of information?
No, I think that's fair to say. Coronary artery disease tends to affect people as they get advancing age. There are some people that get it at a very early age, 30s, 40s. Most people are going to get it with advancing age, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. If you live long enough, you're going to have coronary artery disease. And you probably mm-hmm. do have coronary artery disease if you look in there. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing about our society now, is that because through public health efforts, mostly, mm-hmm. we are no longer dying in childhood and dying in infancy from infectious diseases. Mm-hmm. We have much easier food sources, things like that. People mm-hmm. are living to have coronary artery disease. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you don't make it out of childhood because of infectious diseases, then you don't live to make that. So it's certainly been from the beginning of time, but there are a lot of things in our lifestyle that accelerate that.
Let me remind listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. We're talking about heart disease, primarily disease of the coronary arteries, at least heart attacks. He also has a unique ability to talk about and has training in patient safety, population health, and I'm hoping to get into that a little bit. If you have questions or comments about what you're listening to today, you can call us locally at 550-8433. You can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Also remember, you could be listening to this program tonight between 8 and 9, and we will not be here. That'll be a taped rebroadcast. So if you have questions or comments that are coming up, why don't you call us or email us right now. So there are multiple factors leading to injury to the coronary arteries. Then there is, I'm envisioning, slow narrowing over time. And when I was in training, there might be collaterals that come up. Blood vessels kind of work around these things. But then there's also people who just suddenly, in my age, Jim Fix was a big runner. He was running one day, collapsed, and despite all the exercise, he didn't make it. We've had a very, very good friend and pediatrician who died suddenly, who was in very great shape here. What's the difference between those two kinds of scenarios?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in general, when you talk about coronary artery disease that causes chest pain that happens or some sort of angina that happens when you exert yourself, that's that gradual narrowing. But when you talk about a heart attack, oftentimes a sudden heart attack, usually that's not necessarily that gradual narrowing of these blockages that are becoming 80, 90, 100% blockages. Oftentimes it's smaller blockages that actually cause the heart attack. And it's that that blockage itself with the cholesterol, if that ruptures, so that breaks off, the material inside actually makes the blood clot very quickly. And it's that that rupture, that sudden breakage of that material that causes a blood clot to form there, and then that causes a very quick heart attack. So that vessel may go from a 20% blockage or a 40% blockage to suddenly 100% blockage, and that's actually what causes a lot of the acute heart attacks that that happen. Mm-hmm. That said, we do have treatments that can actually stabilize those plaques some, and there are certainly a lot of different risk factors and lifestyle things that can make you more or less likely to have one of those heart attacks. However, sometimes it's also genetics are one of those things that it's very difficult to escape, and we have many patients who do everything right and have no risk factors and still have heart attacks, which is too bad. But luckily, we have good treatments for them.
All right. So, as I recall, and I didn't prepare enough for the show to go back and look statistically, but I think of back through the 70s, maybe the early 80s, the incidence of coronary artery disease was increasing, and then somewhere along that time, things have changed, and incidence is new cases. So people coming to the healthcare system with new symptoms of coronary artery disease or tests that show coronary artery disease have apparently been decreasing, and as well mortality. Let's take the incidence of new situations first. Why is that thought to be the case? What has caused this change in what looked like an inevitable progression of heart disease, of coronary artery disease?
Yeah, that's great. So you're exactly right that both the incidence, so how many people get coronary artery disease, and the mortality, so who dies from coronary artery disease after they get it, are both decreasing. When you take the incident part of that, a lot of that is from prevention efforts. And so there's been overall a decrease in smoking rates, which is a huge part of it. There's also been a increase in the use of a lot of medications that decrease heart disease, particularly statin medications, which are cholesterol medications, cholesterol-lowering medications that have had a huge effect at a population level of decreasing the incidence of cardiovascular disease, and then other things like decreasing hypertension, things like that. But it's mostly the prevention efforts that have decreased the incidence.
All right. Gene, I think this might be a reasonable time for us to take one of our two breaks. So I'm going to go ahead and do that. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1, you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on heart disease, particularly coronary artery disease, with Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. We're talking about heart disease, particularly causes and prevention. maybe a little bit about treatment of coronary artery disease. That's disease of the arteries that lead to the heart and are well known to be the problem when someone has a heart attack. You can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Wednesday evening, it's a taped recording. And you can call and write all you want, but you're not going to get anything back. So this is the time to have your questions answered that are on your mind. So we have worked our way up to the fact that the incidence of coronary artery disease has somewhat unexpectedly, began to decrease, that is, new cases. And I, for the longest time, said, oh, it has to be to the decrease in smoking that is going on. And now I think of it as probably one of two major factors, but you may be able to tell me about more. I learned during the hosting this program that statins have been incredibly successful. So let's talk about, everybody knows you shouldn't smoke. Let's talk about statins. What are statins? Have they significantly contributed to the decline of the incidence of coronary artery disease? Why is it? And then I want to also talk about how social media may be working against a lot of people who should be taking statins.
Yeah. So statins are cholesterol-lowering medications that are fantastic medications that get a bad rap, and an undeserved one, unfortunately. And just to be clear, statins, especially the most effective ones, are generic. They're inexpensive. Drug companies. I haven't taken any money from drug companies. I don't think they've offered, but but even if they did, I wouldn't take it. Mm-hmm. So statins actually are probably one of the reasons why the incidence and the prevalence of cardiovascular disease has gone down. It's probably one of that and smoking cessation are probably some of the biggest factors for why less people are getting heart disease and less people are having heart attacks or second heart attacks. Statins are medications that decrease cholesterol, and they work on the liver, which actually is what makes cholesterol for you. But they do more than that. We actually know that it, aside from their cholesterol-lowering properties, even if you have a completely normal cholesterol or even a low cholesterol, if you take a statin, you're less likely to have a heart attack or a stroke if you're at high risk of those things. And we think that that's actually an anti-inflammatory effect that they have that's that has nothing to do with their cholesterol-lowering properties. And if you remember, we talked about that inflammation that starts that heart disease and that inflammation. We also talked about how a lot of people that have heart attacks, it's that that cap or that plaque that breaks apart and then causes the thrombus. Statins actually increase the thickness of that cap that protects the cholesterol in narrowing of the arteries from breaking open. So it probably also stabilizes the plaque that you have as well as, or then the blockages that you have, as well as decreasing the incidence that blockage gets worse. They're fantastic medications. Hopefully someday they'll put me out of business. But until then I'll keep working. They do get a bad rap, mostly from highly publicized side effects.
Yeah, so now information is more available than and quickly at our fingertips than ever has been. And I'm going to say, unfortunately, people think they know how to assess the quality of that information, but really get fooled. And humans, it turns out, like stories more than they like facts. Mm-hmm. So on social media, people will say, I took a statin, I have terrible muscle pain, somebody else is on a statin, may have muscle pain, and stops this medication, or I don't know, whatever you hear on a daily basis, but we've done a program in the past about the significance of this. And how do we know for sure, rather than just stories, about the safety of statins? And nothing, nobody's trying to say that there's no risk, but the safety of statins for the vast majority of people who may need them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you bring up a really good thing about you've heard stories. You know, my cousin's best friend took a statin and had muscle aches. It must be that must be very frequent. And that's proximity bias, right? Mm-hmm. I know somebody who died in a commercial plane crash. Therefore, commercial airlines must be very dangerous. But that's not actually the case. And when you're trying to find evidence, you you do research, and research and large trials and things like that with carefully controlled conditions is how we know what something is actually true, right? It's medical epistemology. It's the same way that if I roll a if you roll a dice and you get two sixes in a row, I don't say your dice is definitely loaded. Mm-hmm. It's maybe that was just chance. But if you roll it 50 times and they're all sixes, well, now I'm a little bit more, now I'm not going to play games with you anymore. But it's that same thing, is that you have to repeat things. You can't just have one single person that has this this effect. And so when we look at the large trials of lots of different patients, the incidence of actually having side effects, especially serious side effects, is very low. Mm-hmm. There's actually a really good study that compared the rate of people stopping taking their statins for usually for muscle cramping between people that were taking a statin and then people that were taking a placebo, so a sugar pill, not a statin. And the rates were about the same. So people stopped taking their sugar pill for about the same at about the same rate for side effects as they did for the statin. So which tells you that, I mean, obviously the sugar pill is probably not causing much. So, you know, these side effects, again, while some people do have side effects and some people are actually intolerant of statins, there are lots of things that we can do about that. There are lots of different statins, and we and working with your physician or your cardiologist to be able to find one that works for you without causing any side effects is actually a really important thing and might prevent you from having a heart attack.
So for most of us, the primary principles for preventing coronary artery disease is weight control, don't get diabetes, don't smoke. If you have certain risk factors, talking with a cardiologist, your primary care physician, statins are extremely important. Even if you have side effects, there are ways around those. And even if you have side effects, you have to ask yourself, what's the risk of continuing versus the risk of not continuing, which could be a life-threatening decision. What else am I missing? Exercise.
Mm-hmm. I think you got a lot of the high points in terms of not smoking. The other one is see a doctor. I have a lot of patients that are, you know, in their 70s and 80s that come in with a heart attack, and while I'm taking care of them, I say, "Do you have any medical problems?" And they say no, and I say, "When was the last time you saw your doctor?" When I was 18.
Right.
So it's very easy to not have any medical problems if you never look for any medical problems. And right. So you should occasionally see a doctor. It's a good idea.
Another preventative measure that is confusing still to me is aspirin. Tell us the aspirin story for coronary artery disease, as it relates to coronary artery disease.
It is confusing to you because it is confusing to everyone. So aspirin is one of those things where we have this love-hate relationship where every few years we go back and forth on it. Really, it's more complex, as it usually is, than aspirin good, aspirin bad. There's a difference between primary prevention and secondary prevention. And what I mean by that is primary prevention means I've never had something before, but I want to prevent it. I've never had a heart attack, but I don't want to have one. Secondary prevention is I've already had a heart attack, but I'd like to prevent a second one, or a stroke, similar. In secondary prevention, so people already have coronary artery disease, or already have many other diseases, have had a stroke, carotid disease, any other cardiovascular disease, aspirin is very good. If you've had a stent, aspirin is absolutely essential. It keeps that stent open. Those things are, and you should never stop your aspirin without your cardiologist's permission. Where it gets a little bit more plus or minus is in normal, healthy patients that don't have a whole lot of medical problems. Mm-hmm. And those people, aspirin is probably not going to hurt them, but it might does cause, in large studies, a little bit more bleeding or a little bit more stomach upset. But it may not be hugely helpful either. However, I think that the amount of people that we have that actually have a lot of risk factors for heart attacks and strokes is relatively large. And so if you take a very, very healthy population, maybe aspirin doesn't help. But most people, in my practice, most people that have enough risk factors for having heart attacks, which are oftentimes men over a certain age with either diabetes or hypertension, or women about the same, then aspirin can actually help them prevent.
Okay. All right. We have a phone call, and I've got an email I want to try to answer questions for. Donna, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Is that me?
Yep, it is.
Okay. All right. I just want to know if there's a correlation between autoimmune disease and heart disease.
What particular autoimmune disease are you referring to, or just autoimmune diseases in general?
In general, but in particular, maybe psoriatic arthritis sort of things. I have some.
Yep.
And I got some things going on. I'm not even sure what it is, but it's related to psoriasis and the Raynaud's syndrome in my fingers and toes and things like that.
Okay. All right. Gene, what's an autoimmune disease? How does it relate to coronary artery disease?
Absolutely. Thanks, Donna. Hi. There is, for sure, a lot of different autoimmune diseases, and that's a very big category, can cause heart diseases in themselves. They can cause heart failure. They can cause inflammation in the sac of the heart called pericarditis. They can cause problems with the lungs that are attached to the heart and then can cause elevated pressures in there called pulmonary hypertension. But if you're asking about coronary artery disease, the answer is yes for that too. Autoimmune diseases oftentimes cause inflammation, and there is an increased risk for coronary artery disease in many of them, including other diseases that cause inflammation. HIV is a big one that people don't think of, but HIV is a risk factor for coronary artery disease and actually other heart diseases, independent, even if you are well treated. Good question.
All right. Thanks for your call,
thanks.
Donna. All right. An email. This is from a 69-year-old female retired physical education teacher who has had a replacement of her aortic valve. It's metal. Has a history of family history of heart disease. Her dad had a stroke. Her mom had heart failure. Her grandma had an aneurysm. And she wants to know more about diet. In particular, she wants to know about whether women should or should not take calcium. She says she eats a healthy diet, high in fiber, fish, low fat, and gluten. She takes a statin, although her cholesterols are okay. You might want to comment on that. It's up to you. But the issue here is there a danger of taking calcium-causing clots? Should she take calcium? This is a woman who's probably also hasn't said it, but she may be worried about osteoporosis and problems related to bone health. And so how would you answer that question?
Yeah, and actually that's a relatively common thing because I talk about calcification of the arteries and people ask me, well, should I not take calcium?
Right.
And that's not really the case. There are a lot of bone health benefits to the calcium. So I wouldn't say that you shouldn't take calcium supplements because of heart disease in general. When you talk about diet, She actually probably has some specific diet things that she needs to do because of the mechanical valve that she has. She's probably on warfarin, which is also called Coumadin. You have to be careful about vitamin K, and that's something that I'd... that's something that she should talk to her cardiologist about. Hopefully she has a cardiologist. Yeah. If she doesn't, come see us. But in general, I would say that I wouldn't worry about calcium. I would worry about trying to avoid fast food, trying to eat as many vegetables as you can, trying to cook as many of your own meals.
Okay. So stay active. Don't worry about the calcium. And the reason calcium is an issue in coronary artery disease is...
Well, calcium is part of the blockages, but just because it's part of the blockages doesn't mean that decreasing your calcium intake will actually lead to better things. That's a very big theme in cardiovascular disease. There are a lot of medications other than statins that can actually decrease cholesterol, but when you look at it, even though they make those numbers better, they don't actually make the outcomes better. They don't actually make the you less likely to have a heart attack, and so that's why statins are so special. So it's we don't want to treat the numbers. You want to treat the person.
You're listening to Line One on Alaska Public Media. My guest is Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute here in Anchorage. We're talking about heart disease, particularly coronary artery disease. Let me remind you again, if you have questions, you can call us locally over the next 15 or 20 minutes, 550-8433, email address line1@alaskapublic.org. Another email has come in. This is from a male who says, my father died in mid-stride at 70, in 1978 at 48 years of age. So he was very young. He was part of a Framingham heart study. I'm 64, type 2, he says, so I'm assuming that's type 2 diabetes. Takes statins, cycles 5 days a week, daily walks his dog, had a stroke in 2010. 99% recovered. Now I drink one 26-ounce Foster's. It's a beer 4 to 5 times a week after cycling. Have read that varying, quotes, amounts, in quotes, of alcohol are okay. So this is a question about, in general, the generic question is alcohol and heart disease. And remember, when anybody talks about this, we're talking about large groups of people. Each individual person may have significant different risks. So I want to throw that in there, although I think Dr. Quinn has mentioned that already. And that's very important to remember that there are lots of general guidelines, but individual may have risk factors or situations that make things very personal. Yep.
Yeah. First off, I'm so sorry for the loss of your father. That's tragic. Early heart disease is a terrible thing, and I think it's really good that you've taken it upon yourself to make sure that that you're as heart healthy as possible. And you can certainly talk with your physician about your individual risks and anything that you can do to decrease it. Alcohol with cardiovascular disease is a really interesting thing. That's kind of like aspirin. It goes back and forth. I would say that my general practice is not to tell people that don't want to drink to start drinking to decrease their risk. Definitely, if you have more than one drink or your recommended amount of drinks per day, that can definitely damage the heart. I'm not sure. I'd have to calculate what 26 ounces of Foster's is in terms of standard drinks. But usually one drink a day won't hurt you. I don't know that I would do it for cardiovascular health, but it might have other benefits, certainly. So red wine maybe may or may not be good for the heart, but might be good for the soul.
Okay. Thanks very much. I'm going to take one more call before our next break. Frank, you're on line one.
Yes, I'm male, 75 years old. I have a doctor that I see for health reasons, just to stay healthy. But within a month, developed a heart murmur. And he says it's not that much, but is this pretty typical of older people? And would aspirin help to prevent it to get worse? I guess just asking about heart murmurs.
Okay. You were breaking up a little bit with your age. What was your age?
75.
75.
Healthy, active.
Healthy, 75, makes a mistake of going to the doctor. The doctor says you got a heart murmur. What's the deal here?
You got to stay away from those doctors. No, please don't do that. So heart murmurs. A heart murmur is just turbulence of the blood flow. It's a sound that you can hear on the stethoscope. And there's lots of different types of heart murmurs. Some are very benign and some are not. And it depends. It depends upon the murmur. What I would, and again, it's difficult through the phone, but many older people do develop murmurs, and oftentimes the valves do tend to get calcified and not open as well as we get older, and that might be what's going on. It's tough to tell how much and if it's something that you would actually need to be treated for, or if it's something that we need to watch on, if it's something that would progress over the course of many years. That would be something like aortic stenosis. So it is difficult to tell you if it's a big deal or not. But keeping an eye on it is a good thing, and it is not uncommon in as we get older. Unfortunately, there are some things that get better with age, but the human body is not always one of them.
And I believe, Frank, if I'm not mistaken, you also ask about aspirin in this situation. And again, I'm going to ask Dr. Quinn to answer that, but we may not have enough information is my guess here.
Yeah, so sometimes it goes back and forth about aspirin I wouldn't do it for a heart murmur, but for certain valve conditions, and again, valve condition, to be able to figure out what that valve condition is that's causing the murmur, which is just something that you heard. Some of those can be, it can be a little bit better with aspirin, especially if you've ever had a valve replacement, which I doubt you have, but if you get a valve replacement, oftentimes we use aspirin. It's a very good question, though.
Thanks for your call. All right, one more break. I want to remind everyone you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and we'll continue our discussion on coronary artery disease with Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Funding for Line 1, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. If you've been listening, you're well aware that my guest today is Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. We're talking about heart disease, particularly the causes and prevention of diseases of the coronary arteries, which leads to heart attacks, ischemia, and sometimes heart failure, and can cause rather sudden death. If you have questions, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433, and you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And between 8 and 9 on Wednesday night, if you're listening, it's a taped recording, and we will not be able to answer your questions. We have about 15 minutes left. I have a couple of phone calls. I definitely want to spend some time talking about some special training that Dr. Quinn has had on patient safety. So I'm going to just maybe take one or two phone calls, and then we're going to go into that. And then however time is left, we'll try to answer more phone calls or talk about hypertension a little bit. So the next patient or next call is Crystal. Crystal, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Good morning. I was wondering about Takotsubo. It happened to me, and the first time was 2008, and I was told it wouldn't happen again, but it did in 2016. And I'm just wondering, Is there a third possibility on that?
That's very interesting. So Takotsubo. Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy is it's rare. Sorry, it's never nice to have a rare thing. I apologize, Crystal. But it is actually named after a Japanese octopus trap. That's what Takotsubo is, and that's what the heart looks like when it's in there. You can Google images of it if you're so inclined. Definitely people that have had one episode of Takotsubo cardiomyopathy are more likely to have another one. I'm sorry that you had a second one. There might be a third one. It's tough to tell. I would definitely, if you don't already have a cardiologist, I would see a cardiologist. But the good news is that by definition, it's not any blockages of your coronary arteries or anything like that. But you can get very significant symptoms, and you can get very sick from Takotsubo cardiomyopathy as well.
Yes. All right. Yeah, I did. And I was fortunate enough to be released by my cardiologist just this past June after a year of monitoring. And so I was just curious as to whether or not it would happen again.
Yeah, if I was you, I'd still be curious if it happened twice. I don't blame you at all. And so there's no real predictive algorithm or anything other than if you had it once, you're a little bit more likely than somebody else that's never had it happen again.
Yeah, and the colloquial term for this is broken heart syndrome. It's this episode of very severe stress usually that brings it on, and it's and we think it's catecholamine adrenaline mediated and things like this. There are some it's an active area of interest. It usually does happen that whenever anybody says this isn't gonna, I think we're safe. We're out of the woods. Nothing's gonna happen again. Then that's when it does happen again. But you may have to go back to it. Continue to have a friend that's a cardiologist for a little while longer. I apologize.
Okay. Well, right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Good luck, Crystal. Great question. Thank you. All right. So, again, despite the fact we have three calls and not a lot of time, I want to do this. In 20 years of hosting Line One Weekly, I have never had anybody had a fellowship in patient safety and quality, and yours is from Harvard Medical School. I want to know about that. What was the purpose? What happens when you're in training, and how are you using it now at the Alaska Heart Institute?
Yeah, I guess I'm not surprised that you've not had one of us on there. There aren't that many of us. I think that I'm still the only cardiologist to have graduated from that. So, patient safety and quality. So what this was, it was a two-year fellowship through Harvard Medical School to talk about quality. And quality in healthcare is an interesting thing. You know, we usually think of healthcare as you do it and then hopefully things get better. And quality is really about not just the amount of healthcare, but it's hard to say it without saying quality again, the quality of that healthcare and the outcomes that you get from it. And one of the really important aspects of that is patient safety. Quality is really easy to define, most people will say. Actually, even some very expensive consultants will say, oh, you can't define quality, but quality is very easy to define. Quality is healthcare that's safe, effective, efficient, equitable, timely, and patient-centered. And those are the aspects of quality. What is difficult is measuring quality. Those are kind of abstract concepts. And measuring the quality of the care that we give and measuring the outcome of the care that we give is science, and that's what the fellowship is about. The fellowship in quality and patient safety is about training people to be hopefully leaders in quality and safety and looking at systems and systems of care. So not just the individual patient that you see, but how do you take an entire population of patients that is treated by any institution and improve the healthcare of all of them at the same time. So that's where that public health, population health crossroads comes in with that.
And you're using this in Alaska?
I am. I work for Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. I'm the medical director of quality and population health, and we are using it in lots of different ways. Alaska Heart is what attracted me to Alaska Heart, and the opportunity up here is that Alaska Heart is actually one of the largest integrated care systems in Alaska. We do a large percentage, not all, but a large percentage of the cardiovascular care here. And because of that, because we have such a large network, we're able to do things that that are greater than the sum of our parts, right? You can do things as the Heart Institute that you can't do if you were 30 individual cardiologists. So we're able to do things on the population level, and we're doing things for tobacco cessation. We're doing things for screening for heart disease and vascular disease. We're making our systems safer, more effective, and reaching out to the community and participating with other nonprofits in the state. So it really allows us to build that system level quality of care, so that we're ensuring that our system is consistently delivering the safest, highest quality care that Alaska has to offer.
Okay. Yeah, that's it's always nice to hear that. I think it's become increasingly clear to many, and we've talked about it on this program a number of times, that in the United States, we do a great job in certain things, but overall, compared to many countries, we are not getting the same bang for our buck, and we need to all be trying to figure out how to do that better. And the triple aim is often talked about: quality, access, and cost. And we have the most expensive, but we don't necessarily win on access and quality all the time when compared to other countries.
Yeah,
all
absolutely.
Right. So thanks for that. All right. Let's go back, and we've got a couple minutes to try to answer. Here's an email, and then we'll try to do a phone call or not. This gentleman is calling, says, I have leg cramps. He thinks potassium may reduce these. Is it dangerous to the heart to take potassium? I got to say, you're an unusual man if you don't get leg cramps. I get leg cramps. People get leg cramps. You hear all kinds of reasons why. Basically, it's part of getting old, I think, and activity. But that's my 10 cents worth.
I think you've got an excellent 10 cents. Sometimes people feel a little bit better with potassium. Sometimes people feel a little bit better with magnesium. If it's leg cramps when you're laying there and they're intermittent, it's not your statin. It's not your statin.
Okay, good.
And
yeah, so that's a coincidence causality thing. People that are older have more muscle cramps. People who are older take more statins. That must be the statins causing the muscle cramps, right?
Right. The one the one thing that I would say is that sometimes people that get leg cramps, especially if they have other vascular disease, it can actually be peripheral vascular disease, and it can be blockages. It's just like with the heart. Your heart is a muscle. It needs a certain amount of blood supply. You get blockages in the blood supply to it. You can do the same thing with the muscles of the legs. And classically, that tends to be on exertion that it's worse, and it's better with rest, and that's called claudication, which is a fancy word for legs not getting enough blood. But actually, a large percentage of people don't have typical symptoms of claudication and can have peripheral vascular disease. So that is one thing that you could think about.
And he makes the point is that potassium by dietary or supplements should be okay, even if they don't reduce muscle cramps. And if they do, they do. But he's heard that potassium is bad, and I think this is a quantitative difference. You want to comment on that?
It depends upon the strength of your potassium. If you are using industrial strength or prescription strength potassium, you can certainly harm yourself with it, but little bits of potassium are probably fine. But it also depends upon the other medications that you might be using that that can affect potassium, and lots of cardiac medications do.
All right. We have about 3 or 4 minutes at most. Karen, you're on line one. Let's see if we can get your question answered.
Hi, Doc. My 80-year-old husband has an 80% blockage in his right carotid artery. At what point do we do something about that?
That's a really good question. So it depends upon if he's symptomatic or asymptomatic. And if and to be able to figure out if he has symptoms, you have to take a very careful history. Obviously, blockages in the carotids can lead to strokes, and we don't want that. We have different thresholds for when we intervene, depending upon symptoms. But either way, he should definitely be seen by a vascular surgeon or a cardiologist or both. And hopefully, he's seen with us at Alaska Heart.
Yeah, we are.
Oh, good.
But, I'm just wondering what our timeline might be with this, and I guess I need to talk to my doc directly.
You should, but that even if you don't end up fixing it, it definitely needs to be monitored. So an 80%, I would probably monitor it at least every year, if not every 6 months. And sometimes there can be differences between if they're doing ultrasounds or if they're doing CTs. But your doctor at Alaska Heart will be able to figure that out for sure.
Okay.
But that's a great question.
Thank you.
Yeah, and he should definitely be on an aspirin and a statin. I hope he is.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Take them.
Long term.
Good.
Very
excellent.
Good. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for calling.
All right, we're on our last couple of minutes. I'm not going to be able to get to two callers that are hanging on. I apologize. And my reason for not getting there is I've grown accustomed to ending by asking, what is it that we want to remember from today's conversation? What are the key points in the next 1 to 2 minutes that you want to make sure listeners put in that shelf in their brain to help them prevent particularly and maybe stave off other incidents of coronary artery disease in particular?
Yeah. Coronary artery disease and cardiovascular disease is going down, but it's still the number one killer. And a lot of its improved outcomes are because of the treatments that we have. So don't forget to go to your doctor. And the other thing is I would just second what you said about the healthcare system, that it's not just about the amount of healthcare that you give, and it's definitely not just about the cost, but it's also about the quality and what you're getting for that. That at a system level is really the future of healthcare. And so definitely Alaska Heart is going to be a part of that.
All right. My particular thanks to Dr. Gene Quinn of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute. I've interviewed a number of people, and some physicians are very, very good at bringing things down to those of us who are not physicians and explaining them very well. And Gene, I think you did a great job. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for all the great calls, too.
To continue the discussion today, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org. At that same address, alaskapublic.org, you can find references and key resources used for today's program, and you can go back and listen to other programs as our Line 1 archives can be found at that same address. Next week, Prentice Pemberton is going to continue interviews on Line 1, and his guest is Dr. Kathy von Hippel, and they're going to be discussing telepsychology and how this is helping access and delivery of particularly mental health, particularly in rural areas. Dave Waldron produced today's program. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. I hope you have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.